You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this episode real quick. A big shout out to everybody who's affected by the Pacific Palisades fires. It's been crazy. It's been windy. Dave, I know you had a friend that lost something very valuable in his home.
Yeah, I got two friends. Another friend of mine I just thought about also, who I've known forever, and luckily they all got out.
Yeah, I think life is more valuable than possessions, but still it's devastating to lose any of that. And I know that it would be heartbreaking for me to lose any of my things, let alone all of my things, in one quick instance. So my heart goes out to your friend and your, both your friends that are kind of dealing with any of that. But we have extraordinary musician, multi-instrumentalist, composer, Dave Tweedy with us. How are you, Dave?
I'm good, Nigga. Thank you for having me, man.
Of course, man. It's going to be exciting. Now we can shift gears and get away from the fires and talk music. the thing we love, right? Because that old just... The escapism at its finest, right?
Exactly.
So let me ask you this. What was the moment of zen for you that made you want to become a musician? Was it a song you heard? Was it somebody showing you something on the radio? What was it?
You know, there was a few of them, but I would say this. When I started playing trumpet when I was in the third grade, and I was really attracted to music. And I loved it. Like, just, you know, the radio was always on, so I always heard stuff. But it was really, I was around 10 years old when I walking past this guy's house in my neighborhood, and I kept hearing drums. I didn't really know what that was all, but after two or three days of walking past this dude's house, I walked past and I went and knocked on the door and was like, hey, can I come check it out? And this dude's mom was like, hey, he's in there playing drums. So I went in there and sat for like chilled out for 2 days and just watched and sat down. And the first thing I played was Brick House playing drums.
Wow.
And I was just watching, like tapping on myself to figure the coordination out. And I literally, man, I did that, and I walked home, and I was just like, you know what, man? I'm doing this shit. And I was like,
were you playing trumpet at the time? And then you were just like, wow. So you're what, seven? Is that what you said?
Yeah, I was, yeah, seven or eight playing trumpet. Yeah, third grade, beginning of third grade. And, you know, the thing was is they just, like – they just offered, and you know, back in the day, you know, schools had music programs, so they offered it, and all the cool dudes, all the cool boys, they, you know, I didn't know what I didn't really know what I wanted to play. I knew I loved music, and I was just like, okay, all the cool dudes are playing trumpet, I'll play trumpet because then I could fit in with them, and you know,
yeah,
that went a few years, but the drum thing, that's what really grabbed me.
Well, the other thing too, trumpet is a hard instrument to learn. I mean, especially at that age, you got to get that embouchure, and it's
yeah,
just like,
man,
that's tough on the lips, man. It's especially at that age, you know.
I didn't mind that so much. It was carrying the thing back and forth from the bus to home. That was right. Look at me. I was like, yeah, the trumpet's a pain in the ass. Why don't we play drums?
You're like, those would be much easier to take to get.
Yeah, that'd be way easier.
We don't know hardware. We don't know how much those bags weigh.
We don't have things cost, man. Jesus.
Right. And you know what? I always think about hardware the most. Whenever, like, if a drummer's like, hey, man, I need some help getting, you know, gear out of my car, I'm like, I know that hardware bag is coming my way. It's the worst. They usually give me, like, the kick, maybe snare. But, I mean, I know that hardware bag's just around the corner, you know. It's just what it is. It's like, I get it. It's like, you know, any relief that you can get, I would want the same thing. So,
yeah. The funny thing with the hardware bag, too, goes when you're loading out of the gig, after the gig, and everyone's drunk. This is always the case, right? And especially if it's like a multi-band, you know, ticket or whatever, and you're trying to do your thing. I'll walk through, and there'll always be some people that just won't get out of the way. And I have a rule of three. So the first time I'm like, hey, excuse me, I'm already coming through with a bunch of hardware. And then, hey, man, I'm definitely coming through with hardware. Third time, I don't say shit. I just come through hard. <I'm> like, yeah. Take that hardware case in your way.
You super dumb. You know, it's like,
I told you twice.
Yes. No, you deserve that, you know, and it's also like, I always think too, it's like, man, it's amazing that they have not invented some kind of like, I don't know if it needs to be some crazy iron or plastic or a combination of that would be lighter. Like,
well, they have Yamaha has this really lightweight aluminum hardware now. That's
okay. Wow.
Lightweight. And the other thing that happens, you know, I'm not on the bandstand like that, you know, anymore, seems to be, other than when I'm touring, but back in the day, man, I just broke my kit down to what I call the keep it real kit, which was just a hat, you know, kick and a snare and a cymbal. And that's all
a lazy doing. Drummer. You're like, I can make people move with just this and I'll do it. And you know what? That's smart.
Lazy. Yes. There's some truth to that too. It was like, I'm not bringing all this other crap. But you know, the funny thing now, because I do so much work with my own project, I love having my full kit and having all my stuff. And I'm endorsed by a company called Timbro Drums. They're from Italy. And they just sent me a whole set of hardware. Actually, I got to do an unveiling of in about 2 weeks when I go back to the Bay Area.
That's cool.
To open it up. Yeah. Because I needed another set of hardware.
When did you start a band? Were you in marching band? Because I remember I wanted to take drums. I still tease my dad about this. I'm like, I wanted to play drums when I was in middle school for band. And he was like, you know what? You should play the clarinet. And I'm like, man, the clarinet had no musical value for me on my journey whatsoever, where drums would have had a major influence on me as a musician. Clarinet had zero.
It's like, you can lead to being a saxophone player. That was the cool thing. But the dudes that played flute or clarinet when we were kids, we were like, interesting. Okay.
That's so funny. Well, you
know, the dudes have to be badasses, but you know.
I brought a tenor saxophone home, but those, you talk about a trumpet being heavy. Yeah, those tenor saxophones were so heavy. So yeah, my dad was like, he's like, I got a clarinet. Why don't you play that? That's a reed instrument. I'm like, all right, I'll play the clarinet. But my heart was always like, I want to play drums because that was the coolest. So did you play in like jazz band, marching band?
Yeah, so sort of all of the above. So how it all kind of played out was I started on a kit, and then I went to a new junior high and they had a kit there. And so I could play there on that kit. And then the high school in the small town that I grew up in, Northern California, had a really good marching program. And it was cool. It was actually back then, this is back in the day, this is in the 80s, it was cool to be in the marching band for sure, right? Right. So
I was in the marching band. I know.
Yeah. So it was
hot. It was always hot in the marching
band. Oh, my God. Wool uniform. Yeah,
that was brutal.
My eighth grade, I was like the water boy for the fucking marching band. So because they needed, on the competition, But I was already friends because I was really, I got good at drums fairly quick. I was coordinated. And so the older drummers who were all juniors and seniors took me under their wing because I could lay funky. I could be funky, you know, which was like everybody else was just all like whatever they were doing. So they liked me. So I was cool doing that. They didn't treat me weird. Or they didn't treat me, you know, it was actually kind of cool. And so I did that for 2 years, and then I transferred to another high school, which was Pinole Valley High up in the Bay Area, which was kind of known. Honestly, it's, at the time, I didn't know it was going to be this, but they did some articles they've written about it. It was called Rock and Roll High School up there because a lot of different musicians, including myself and Billy Joe and Mike Dern from Green Day went there, and Larry LaLonde from Primus went there, and my buddy Jeff Becerra, who was the bass player for a death metal band called Possessed, who were like kind of the originators of that music form.
It was like metal and punk, like that was.
Yeah, my friend Rosanna was she's the East keyboard player. She was a keyboard player. The guitar players are all guys. One of my friend Danny Jones was in guitar player a bunch. So there was a bunch of people that ended up in Northern California in that particular high school because Berkeley and Oakland would get all the juice in terms of like all the jazz guys, but we were sort of like more pop and rock out there. So yeah, I ended up going there, and they had a jazz band out there also. So that I, you know, and I still have the band because it was, you know, it was the mid 80s, so it was not cool to have like a sparkly drum set anymore, right? That was it. So they decided, oh, we're gonna get the cool, like, you know, black or white stuff, we're gonna just get rid of this old Ludwig drum set. And I was just like, I can take that over here. So they just take this shit home. So yeah, I still have
it. Take it home, that you don't have to pay anything.
No, man, they gave it to me.
And you still have it?
I still have it. Yeah. Well, I have the floor tom and the kick drum, and still that inspired me to go get like a full on like 60s Ludwig kick, because for doing session work, that's like one of the, you know, it's like a cornerstone of summer sessions. Yeah.
Meat and potatoes for rock and roll, all the Bonham stuff.
All the pop, yeah, blues, the kick drum is just like, I'll bring that to any session and it's money. It's just,
what is it, 24? It's big.
22, it's 22 by 14.
Okay.
right. Yeah, but it's, but those shells are thin, and you know, I'm like, I do all this riding, I do all this other stuff, but I will always, and I am always going to be a drum nerd.
That's awesome. And you know what? I'm a drummer still in here. So like, drummers are my favorite because right. like, there's something about timing. There's something about like just the vibe. There's, and it starts with drums. It starts with drums. It starts with voice. Those are the two things. So I think,
yeah, it's
singers
it's,
love drummers and drummers love singers just because of those two things.
If, so. Well, if you got a good singer, you got a good drummer, you got a good band.
That's true.
For, at least for a live situation.
In usually the, they just say a band is only as good as its drummer. I like that you threw the vocalist in there. That's good.
Man, you hold their presence, but if you got a killer singer and a killer drummer, man, now you got some shit.
That's true.
You know,
do you remember what you played in jazz band? Were you playing like standards, bebop, or kind of like an array of stuff?
Well, there's a few things. So yeah, it was they were throwing kind of standards at us. You know, the fact of the matter though, I was not even really interested in it. I was just interested in playing drums, and I was like, I remember they kind of showed us the Spyro Gyra song, and then they're also showing trying to show us like the Flintstones. Everybody was into it, but that's a hell of a drum part, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
All those old compositions are so wicked, dude.
Yeah, man, it's all those hits, and that was way above my pay grade. So I was kind of a bonehead rock and roll, just pocket drummer, and that went on until I was about 22, and then maybe a little earlier, and I finally took some drum lessons. I was self-taught, I'm self-taught on everything, so I'm a little bit.
So you're like a musical savant, basically.
Yes, I have there's definitely a streak of savant. I've never taken lessons on melodic instruments, and I score films. I do all the crazy shit.
That's amazing.
I have a sort of, you know, it's almost like I won't say a photographic memory because I don't have that, but when I hear something, like I know what it's supposed to be, and then I just sort of have to fill in the gaps. It's already in my head. So I just
That's amazing.
Just go at it. And
it's funny with me. It's like I always like learn from people, and then I just don't want to learn necessarily from the same person or the same lessons. So I'll kind of like take what they teach me and then just run with it. Like I'll just experiment like crazy, whether it's like if somebody shows me a tuning, for example, I'm like, oh, whoa. And then I'll just like go into my room and just like go crazy with that tuning and try to write something. But there's something about like just being able to figure it out on your own, you know, without any of that help was like, that's almost too much for me. Cause I'm like, I need some, like, give me some bones to work with so that I can build something. You know what I mean?
I will say this, and I get my guitars right here. I play guitar pretty much every day. And I did, when I was in high school, one of the classes that I had was, I was the assistant to the music teacher for the guitar playing class. Now I couldn't really play guitar, but I sort of figured it out. But Larry, actually Lalonde, taught me how to play a minor pentatonic scale.
Wow.
And he showed me how to do the playing fast, like playing like which if I'm not showing the guitar in my hand, and it's funny. So those things, I could always kind of solo across things.
Wow.
Slowly, because I don't have great flexibility. I always say I kind of have more pause because I've been a drummer for so long. But I played.
Well, your time is good already, so that's already something you can use to solo and kind of like.
Yeah, phrasing, and also just like growing up when I grew up, you know, all the solos, you know, anything from the Eagles to Eddie Van Halen, no matter what it was, everything was so put together and conceptually made sense. And to me, so that almost goes into that savant thing, like everything's supposed to sound like that. You know, so if it doesn't sound like that, something's wrong with it. Unless I'm playing like crazy jazz shit, then sure, you know. Then
so your ears are kind of like the print. You know, like what you're hearing is like, okay, I'm memorizing kind of what it sounds like, and then I can kind of facilitate getting close to that or kind of going in a different direction using the same.
Yeah, and maybe even more importantly is like, what's it feel like? Like what do I want? What do I want the listener, or what do I want them to feel from this? What's the sentimentality? And that's so note choice, huge. Like I'm not going to burn with like shred much of shit, but I can definitely phrase and I can definitely hit the notes that like are going to speak in the way that I want them to speak to convey the emotion that I want to convey, you know, through the music or through the song. And the same thing for, you know, scoring stuff. It's the same concept for that. So I'm really, really idiosyncratic in particular about that stuff.
And you said you were like heavily influenced with rock.
Yeah.
Zeppelin was a huge influence because that's like the drummer's drummer.
It's funny. It certainly was. But I think there's a few things that kind of hit me before. Funny enough, hit me before Zeppelin. Like Sabbath was one of the first things that I kind of like kind of play. Boston was another thing.
Great. great.
I don't know how to play triplets from Boston.
That's amazing.
Right. And then Rush was the big, like,
yep. Yep.
Rush and the Police.
That's my one regret is, I played a couple festivals where Rush was on the bill, but they were always on the end or the beginning, and we were on the opposite side. So we never kind of ran in on the same scheduling days. But I regret not seeing them live ever, even though, like, I heard All the World's a Stage and, you know, like, Moving Pictures is a great record. Like, I just love everything they represent, but I never got to see them live. Did you ever see them live by chance?
Yeah, I saw them back in the early 80s. I saw them on the Grace Under Pressure tour and Power Windows tour.
That's awesome.
So I was in high school.
That was an inspiration, just seeing Neil Peart, like, just, like.
Well, and everything leads to everything. I saw the Steve Morris Band open up for Rush, thinking I never could see another power trio that would be as amazing as Rush, and then Steve with Rod Morgenstern playing drums, which was phenomenal. And they have a record called The Introduction that I got back then. That's just like this dude Jerry Peake playing bass and super nerd Southern fusion. They're from Steve Morris was from the Dixie Dregs, which was a Southern fusion band. But they all went to school with Pat Metheny and all the other shit. Right. So it was all.
And I love that you said the Police. That's one of my favorite bands. I got the chance to meet Stuart Copeland real briefly at Coachella, of all places. He was standing right next to me. I was like, "Hey man, are you Stuart Copeland?" And he turned to me and he said, "Sometimes." I was like, "You're cool, man. You're cool." I was like, "Dude, I'm a huge fan. I just wanted to make sure and just tell you I love the music."
Man, I mean, and so that being said, all that music I mentioned, the only thing I really still listen to on a regular basis is the Police.
That's awesome.
I still go back to, especially when I'm traveling. There's so much of that music just sort of makes sense when I'm traveling.
Oh, well, I love all the Sting stuff and all the Police stuff, and I saw them live like 3 times when they toured because I was just such a big fan already. And I'm sure, did you see them when they toured?
I saw them when they came back in the early 2000s. There,
that was
I was like a hair too young when they came the first time. And I wanted to go see Synchronicity, but my parents were like, "No."
Ah, and you're like, man.
You know, the funny thing, ironically, the first concert I went to was Motley Crue and Y&T on a Halloween night, and like. 83 the same time. They're like, "You can go to that concert, but the Police, no, it's San Francisco. I could go to the concert." This is all Bay Area stuff. That's where I grew up.
Right.
So what's
funny is I sang at the Grammys when I was a kid, and I met Motley Crue in their heyday of Dr. Feelgood, but I never saw them play live until like 4 years ago.
Okay.
Like 4 or 5 years ago, right before the pandemic, I saw them with Styx. And I was like, "This is awesome." You know, like, but they were just like, such a like a vital part of rock and roll history because they were just the hair band of hair bands, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, they also had a trip because they had just a hair of punk in them also. Yeah. And I was thinking of that first record, they were a little more FU than the other people were a little more about partying, and they were certain about that, but the way their music kind of came across and their thing, there was something a little more raw, especially the first record was pretty raw recorded. And that, you know, I ended up like liking punk also in the late 80s and went to a bunch of, I saw a whole episode on that and thrash metal and all that stuff. I was around all that stuff when it kind of exploded in the Bay Area. Like literally my friends were all in all like Exodus, and I saw Slayer when they first came through. And the funny thing is I wasn't really into that stuff. So, right. I was more melodic. I was more, they would call it the poser stuff. I love me some Rat. And obviously I love Van Halen. Oh my God.
Melodies. You like melodies. That's like everything. That's how I am too. I love all the rock stuff. I can dig on metal, but I really love melodic stuff.
Yeah.
Great drums, great groove, great parts, great hooks. Yep. So did you start a band in high school? Like what was the first kind of incarnation of you being in a musical group?
My buddy Scott Holderby is his name. He was in a band called Mordred later on, but when they were like a thrash funk band that toured everybody. So him and I, we grew up in a little town called Crockett, up in Crockett, California. My parents still live there. And we had a little band we were called Fury. And that was our first band. So then I get into my next high school, I had a few other bands, and then all kind of rock bands, heavy rock bands. But I kind of broke through with a pop band that there was a thing, there was a magazine called BAM Magazine that was up in the Bay Area, and they had a thing called the BAMies every year. They turned into the Callies later on, but it was a big thing in the Bay Area. And the band that I got, they were called Chris Loiter and the Hangouts. It was a pop rock band, and they'd won a BAMie. And so I got on to, you know, join with them, and it was an amazing experience. It was almost like a business thing that I did because I didn't love the music, man. I was listening to Primus and like all the other stuff that was kind of coming out of that at that time, you know, Jane's Addiction, all that stuff.
Love all that stuff.
Yeah, me too. This was more like Greg Kinn, you know, we were more like that. And so, but the great thing was I got to open up for everybody, man. It was like Chris Isaac and, you know, say like Greg Kinn and Dickie Betts from the Allman Brothers. Like, a lot of stuff like that. Yeah, Elvin Bishop, Clarence Clemons, just sort of a litany of like these artists like that. So I got to be around, and I got to the first record I did. I was like 19. We did it at the record plant with a guy named Jim Gaines, who had just done the Huey Lewis and the News Sports record.
Wow!
So I get to work with him. Yeah. So it was like pretty deep, by the time I'm 19, I'm signed. I'm up there, and the Bay Area had a killer music scene up there at that point.
Right,
so
right, well, you had all the bands coming from the 70s from up there, like Tower of Power and all of that.
Yeah, Santana. So, yeah, yeah, that, Journey. Yep.
That's right. So did you get influenced by that scene and that style because of that, or not really?
The thing was that it was sort of three things happening all at once. One was I discovered that drumming was absolutely its own world unto itself.
Right.
Obviously, it was in service to music and songs, but it was also its own just huge world. So I was being influenced. The same time I'm doing that stuff, I'm listening to Mahavishnu. I'm listening to Jeff Beck with Simon Phillips. I'm listening to all this crazy drummer jazz fusion shit, and really, really attracted me and really spoke to me. So that was always in the background. I was always working on that stuff and finding opportunities. And so that kind of happened. Then up in the Bay Area, the whole acid jazz scene happened. So it was a perfect, it came together at the same time. And it was amazing because I was like, I want to be part of this. All this other shit, that's cool. This is some shit though, because it had pockets. And a lot of things growing up, I love some Earth, Wind & Fire. I love Sly Stone.
Yes,
you know, I love Stevie Wonder. And that was something that really, really spoke to me in a way that was even beyond playing music. It was just like spoke to me.
And yeah, so it's like you realize like how powerful music can really be when you hear it in those artists. You know what I mean? It's like you hear it's like arrangements. It's like sound design. It's composition. It's spiritual. It's also just like soul. It's just it's the purest of all of it, you know.
Yeah, and it's authentic. There was nobody. People were smiling, you know, when they're making the music, and you could feel, you could kind of feel that in it. And so that really attracted me. So I ended up in the 90s in a Latin, like a 13 piece Latin funk band called Los Angelitos.
That's awesome.
And it was fucking killer, and we won everything you could win in terms of whatever, you know. We won a Bammy up there, same thing. There was a bunch of other things we got. And then we opened up for all sorts of people. I remember we opened up for Morris Day and the Time. We opened up for Fishbone. Like, we're doing it, playing it.
Wow.
Yeah, playing the Fillmore.
Awesome.
It was killer. And the band was smoking. And it just, there was so many opportunities. So then I ended up started playing jazz fusion with people up there. That thing all started happening. And then eventually, by the mid-90s, I had finished that, and then I met a guy named Stephen Bradley, who was the trumpet player and keyboard player with No Doubt. And he was from El Cerrito, and a mutual friend of ours was putting a band together that he'd just done the Tragic Kingdom. He didn't play on that record, but he did that first tour. He's still with him. We're still the best of friends. And so that started a whole other, you know, relationship. The thing with me, man, there's so many different parts of, you know, and it's like anybody who does all this. Some people, if you just play one instrument, but because I was producing, also writing and playing, I was like, I was working with Roger Corman. I'm working with the Latin funk band. I'm still playing with Alex Skolnick from Testament, playing like funk fusion shit over here.
It's funny. It's like for me, it's like I started as like kind of like world music and like funk. And then I started this blues trio recently, and it's like I have the songwriting team to do pop stuff. It's like you have to wear many hats if you love music in all of its forms. But it's also tough because it's like, man, I know you feel like this. It's like you'll be doing something, and then you'll hear somebody do something else really well, and you're like, I want to do that. And then you go to that, and then you hear somebody back to doing something that you were doing, and you're like, I want to go back to that. You know, it's like this constant like ping ponging of musical styles I want to go to, and it's hard.
I think it's good. I think at some point I kind of struck a balance with everything, which was like I distilled it down to this: I love writing songs and I love playing drums, and so when it comes to that, like I can distill it down to that. I produced for a long time. I produced for 20 years, and I enjoyed some of it. Some of it I didn't enjoy at all. Matter of fact, I sort of swore it off during COVID and then come back this last year. And I've got three different people called me to produce, you know, EPs for them.
Out of curiosity, what did you not enjoy about it? Because I wonder if it's the same thing that I
sometimes... Oh, you know, it's just the sort of the thankless sort of part of it where, you know, the thanks would come a few years later, usually when they would really realize what I was trying to do. And the fact is I'd always had my own project. I always had my own world, generally speaking. I just wanted to make it better. And again, because I will take the responsibility for this, that slightly savant side of me hears things very, very done and finished. And so like I'm following a program to get to that place. And a lot of times that maybe wasn't necessarily the vision that they had. And so sometimes maybe I wasn't the greatest producer in that way, you know.
Well, but sometimes you have to sacrifice, even if you think it's the better for the clients.
Yeah.
Really hard, because that's the one thing I don't love about producing sometimes. It's like, man, if you're hiring me as a producer, you're hiring me for all that I can represent and elevate your work. And if I can elevate your work, that means almost you're asking the person to kind of like not get out of the way, but like understand that you see what they can do, and now you can elevate their work, and that trust has to be there. And
yeah.
It's there, and sometimes it's not. It's just,
yeah,
that's a hard.
I will say this to most of these people's credit, if any of the experiences were tumultuous at all, with time, they would always call me back a few years later and be like, "Hey, man, I really appreciate. At the time, I didn't understand what you were trying to do, and I get it now. And I look back, like, and this stuff sounds amazing still, and blah 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 blah." And so that's the part where, like, I always knew that I wasn't doing something to be like, "Hey, look at me. I'm gonna look at my scene." Was my agenda, because I always had my own projects. So I could fully be my own. You know, I was always writing for my own stuff. Or, you know, even when I moved to LA in 2010, I was the composer on So You Think You Can Dance for 4 seasons. Right. I had a publishing deal, sync writing. So I'm doing all this stuff. So when I was working for people, I'm like, basically, they wanted to get stuff synced. They want to have stuff. So I'm just like, look, I'm just going to do what I do that I know how to do, because I've had over 100 songs synced in television films. So if you don't want to do that, you know, but you know, something happened along the way also, is that also, like, I was an early embracer of technology. So I was on Pro Tools in the late 90s. And so I was out at that point really far ahead of a lot of folks when they would come over. And so you could kind of razzle dazzle people pretty good at that point. But as time went on, everyone ended up having a Logic rig on their thing. So part of my sort of stepping back also was like, I really feel like it's really, really important, because this is what I wanted to do. And it's like, just you work on your own stuff and go as far as you can with it, push as far as you can, hit every idea. And if you decide that you want to take it farther, but you don't know how, you give me a call.
Right.
Because I certainly know how to take it as far as you ever want to go with the stuff.
It's hard when you're producing somebody else, just because, you know, I had a client recently and he was just telling me, man, I'm so thankful that, you know, what you did on the record. But one of the songs, I laid down this really cool solo and it was pretty solid. Like, it was a great guitar solo. I was like, okay, I'm cool, I'm done. I was putting the guitar down. I'm like, what do you think? And he was like, well, it's a little busy, you know. And I was just like, oh man, okay, all right. And it wasn't busy, but I was like, all right, let me tone it down. And it would, like, it took me like another maybe 5 to 7 takes to kind of like lose my anger of like, yo, I know this is a great solo, and then get to that place of like, let me play less, let me play more melodic. And it was just a different version of "This Works." And that's a hard place to get and get to the other side. That's the hard part. But at the end of the day, I just want to find something that works. And to me, they both worked.
Yeah.
But somebody may have a preference of one or the other, and that's okay. But it's hard to let go of that.
It's like an interesting balancing act, because you're doing two things at once. You're sort of like, you're trying to be completely in service of the whole thing. You did something that you know is really, really great. And it's not like, hey, look at me, great. It's just like, this is really serves the song really well. Yes. And then someone's like, that's not the thing. And as a producer, like, I almost, that's one thing. As a producer, all that stuff, I'd always like let people steer that part of it. Right. My thing would definitely come down to like lyric writing, to melodies and other stuff. I've encountered this just this last year, where I wrote a song with a songwriter who was definitely signed to Interscope for a bunch of years. He's got a new deal going, and we wrote this song in a church up in Danville. And it was just him and I in the church. And he had he had a lyrical idea. I sat down, I played piano. He sang it. Then I was like, wrote all these other lines, and we started working. We got it all done right there. Put it on an iPhone. It sounded killer. So he worked with all these other writers. He's working down Muscle Shoals, right?
Wow.
And so that song has still made it. And he produced it down there with a bunch of other people because I'm up here. I couldn't make it out there, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that's another whole art in itself of just like, okay, I wrote this shit, and I'm letting it go. And you go, you put the cake together. Comes back. The solo shows up. And I'm like, that is not the solo. So I'm like, that's not the solo. So please send me this is my song. Send me the fucking song so I can lay the solo on this thing, at least to show you. So I send it, and he's like, oh man, I don't know, you know. And then, you know, inevitably I was just like, you know what? Do what you want to do with it. You're singing it. You got to go out and play this. I'm not going to go out and play this every night.
Right.
It's a great song. I've had two other artists already ask me about doing versions of it, which like says a lot about the song. So sometimes it's like, man, it's like we care so much. We want it to be, we just care. And then it's a weird thing of caring, and then you have to like take your hands off the wheels.
This is a great therapy session because you know what? It's like we don't get to have these conversations very much because not many people understand that. But
no,
I understand everything you're saying. Like I've been there, and I know that place. And it's one of those things that I think all producers experience, but we all don't talk about it. You know, it's so funny. But let's play something of yours. What do you want to play us first?
Why don't you play? I have a live. This is my project in spirits with Victoria Theodore, the lovely and amazingly talented Victoria Theodore. And this is a song called Stars that we did for a Tiny Desk to submit for Tiny Desk. And it features some people you might know, like Rod Casho playing guitar.
Okay.
And a host of other people that I'm spacing on their names right now. Philip Black playing saxophone, and Dryn Elliott playing keys, and Maddie, who's last name escaping out, on bass. But anyway, this is something we did for that. And this is my current project that I've been touring. I've been around the world the last 2 years with Victoria.
All right, let's play it. It's called Stars, correct?
Stars, yep.
Here's Stars.
Hi, NPR. We are In Spirits, and this is our Tiny Desk submission. Time passes by. I'm unaware. The TV on, but I don't care. My mind obsessed. A single thought. Sound the alarm. You stole my heart, and I'm helpless. Floating into the dark. Past Orion's belt. Is this heaven feeling things that I'm your kisses light me up like supernovas. Astronautical hearts, there's no stopping us. Gravity, give it up.
All I gotta say is, who the hell didn't watch that or turned it down? Because I hope to God you got that Tiny Desk concert, because that is ridiculous. That was so slamming.
Thanks,
that was,
man.
Great. That was great.
I appreciate
it. You were playing the world's smallest toms, dude.
Yeah, those are my kids. Those are my kid bongos,
dude. That was awesome. I was like, man. I'm like, Dave looks really big, like giant against those.
Yeah,
toms.
It's
so small, dude. It's a
messed up kick, a little 16-inch kick, little tom. Yeah, I was just trying to, you know, do that small thing, and everyone played their asses off. Came down, and yeah. So I actually wrote that song. I was thinking about as I was watching it. Like, funny enough, I wrote the song, the track. I wrote one time I was at the beach. I was out in Malibu, and I was out there chilling, and somebody down the way was playing a ton of music. Ton of hip hop, super fucking loud, super. And I was annoyed. I was like, I don't want, man, this is not what I want to hear. I don't want to hear anything. I just want to hear the ocean, right? Right. I had my phone and I was like, you know what? I just got to listen to something to kind of like put in to mute out whatever this shit is over here. Right. And I went over to Stevie Wonder and from Hotter Than July, I think, Did I Hear You Say You Love Me? And I was. I smoked a little weed, and I was like, I listened to that thing, honestly, about 20, like, and I grew up with that record, man. It was like, I've been on that record since I was a kid, but something about me struck. It was about the drum beat, because the drum beat had this, I changed the drum beat, but the initial thing, with this tom hit, and I was like, man, that is hitting. I actually packed my shit up, went straight to my studio, and I wrote that song, I wrote that track.
Wow.
And it sat there. I had a few different artists, as a producer and as a writer. I got a few folks that are from like The Voice or from American Idol that have come through, and nothing ever happened. And then when Victoria and I put the project together, you know, there's a bunch of her songs. She was just like, hey, is that track still around? Is anybody using that? I was like, nope. And she wrote the words.
That's amazing.
And the top line, and rest is kind of history.
And you know, your wife is no slouch. You know, she's been playing with some heavy hitters. Why don't you just list some of the heavy hitters that she's played with?
Well, she was a touring keyboard player with Stevie Wonder for 8 years or 7 years, excuse me, 2007 through 2014. She was with Beyonce for 6 years. But she was also in the Arsenio Hall show, and she's a musical director. Yeah, she's amazing. You know, the most amazing thing about her is she plays the songs I write. She's not like, I need to write it. She's like, you know, music. Wow. She literally loves the music that I write. And I appreciate you so much for that, Victoria.
Right.
You know, but also it has to be like, and honestly for me, and this goes for anything, it's not just for her. Like, shit's gotta be great, man. I'm not trying to do, it's gotta be great. You know, we like to play great music. I like to play with great musicians. And I want, if I'm in the audience, I want to hear something that's cool.
Yep.
You know,
and for me, I love arrangements. Like, when I heard that keyboard lick, you know, it's like, it's such a cool little riff in there. It's like, okay, there's a huge hook. Okay, the drums are grooving. Okay, whoever that bass player is, my God, what
Maddie.
Awesome. Woo! Oh, my God.
He's just had him play.
It would just be enough, you know, but everybody jamming on that the way they were.
We did two takes of that. That was the second take. And by the way, no click track. That's just in the room. You know, that's just like straight out playing. And the first time he did a very reserved version. I go, hey man, that second verse comes up, like, you just do your thing, bro. So that's what he did.
That's so slam. I mean, those are great players. Everybody in that room was just like slamming. So I question the validity of a tiny desk. Like,
I concur.
You know what I mean? It's like, that is crazy. If that is picked, you got to question the people who are picking tiny desk options.
Well, I would say this at the very least. I know that they saw it and they heard it, you know, and all you can hope is that in the big, you know, out in the universe and somewhere in their psyche, you know, I'm a really firm believer, you know, and sometimes it's a bitter pill to swallow, but everything goes down exactly how it's supposed to go down. And I live my life, you know, by that. And the fact that we've got an amazing video and representation of that song for me is like that to me represents like, that's like the 85 to 90% version of how great that song could be, you know? And if I actually, you know, had all the money in the world, I would pay the very, very best. I'd have horns. I'd have the whole thing. I could hear the 100% version. But to get to hear it in 90% was a thrill, and to have like real documentation. We did 3 songs that day. And so, and they all came out. They all
I came can out. Imagine. We did you ever upload it, you should upload it at the Tiny Tom's concert.
Exactly.
Because, dude, it's just so great. Like, it's got character, and then everybody's slamming, and it's just like, everybody's in one shot. Like, it's just, it's really slamming. It's a great, great video.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We shot that at my studio in downtown LA.
Amazing. It's slamming. It's just, it's amazing that it didn't get to Tiny Desk, but you know what? We're going to show gigs it here. So that's all that matters. You know, that's sometimes it's like, it's, I think artists in general are always ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
And it's like media will only be able to catch the what is marketed towards them, what is greased, you know, to have them play, what is the hot thing at the moment because somebody